Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Josh Richmond, political reporter for the Bay Area News Group, and your moderator tonight. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest tonight, David Bowes. David Bowes is the Executive Vice President of the Cato Institute and has played a key role in the development of the Cato Institute and the libertarian movement. A provocative commentator, Bowes has written articles for publications such as the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, among others, and he is a frequent guest on national shows such as NPR's Talk of the Nation, the McLaughlin Group, and Fox News. Prior to joining the Cato Institute in 1981, Bowes was the editor of New Guard magazine and executive director of the Council for a Competitive Economy. In addition to having written the entry on libertarianism in the Encyclopedia Britannica, Bowes is also the editor of The Libertarian Reader and the author of The Libertarian Mind, A Manifesto for Freedom, which is what we're here to discuss tonight. Please join me in welcoming David Bowes to the Commonwealth Club. So let's start. Give us a little overview of this updated book. This is an updated, revised version of something you had written earlier. And basically what you're hoping to accomplish in this book.
What the book has is some core chapters on the basic principles, values of libertarianism, individualism, toleration, law, the market process. It has an intellectual history of libertarianism going back to the Bible and Lao Tzu and up through John Locke and the American founders and into the 20th century. I think I have three sort of purposes in mind in writing it. One is to give libertarians the best contemporary statement that I could of what libertarianism in the early 21st century is. Second, to write the book that libertarians would want to give to their friends and family who are interested. And third, we've done studies at the Cato Institute that show that tens of millions of Americans are what I consider broadly libertarian. When you ask them value questions about the role of government in society, they give libertarian answers to several of those questions. But I think very few of those people would call themselves libertarians. It's probably never occurred to them. So one of the things I want to do is tell those people, if you consider yourself fiscally conservative and socially liberal, if you think you want government out of your bedroom and out of your pocketbook, if you think the government gets involved in too many wars overseas and spends too much money here at home, then you just might be a libertarian and you should give the book a try.
All right. Well, early on in the book, you talk about some of these basic precepts in introducing the concept, and you talk about how freedom leads to social harmony. You talk about so long as there's respect for the equal rights of others, which is an important qualification. But you talk about a natural harmony of interests among peaceful, productive people in a just society, that we all prosper from the operation of the free market. But isn't some of that freedom and prosperity inherent on the capital that you have to start with? We are not starting from the same place, all of us. And so isn't some of the freedom and prosperity we enjoy dependent on where we start from in terms of our wealth, our geography, the education that we're able to receive, the job opportunities that exist where we are? Aren't there external factors that have something to do with this, so that perhaps the free market does not help make everybody prosper the same way?
Well, everybody in society can have the same freedom. We're not going to all have the same prosperity or the same wealth. We are all going to benefit from the operation of the free market. There was a time when everyone was poor. Whether you're talking about Adam and Eve or indeed around 1700, everybody was still poor. There were kings. They had political power, and of course they had ermine robes. But the fact is that even the kings in those days were poor in so many ways that in a modern market society we can't even imagine. What brought us out of that desperate, backbreaking poverty that afflicted everyone was the working of the market. Never an entirely free market, but the countries that tried relatively free markets came out of poverty a lot faster than the countries that tried relatively less free or completely unfree markets. So yes, what has increased our standard of living by something like 50 times in the modern Western world is the working of the market in a society largely governed by the rule of law, property rights, equal rights under law, always imperfectly, but the societies that approximate this libertarian ideal have done a lot better by all of their citizens than the societies that veered far away from it.
But there has to be some role for a public presence in that square as well, right? I mean, life is better today. We talk about technology, things like the internet or infant formula or microchips or GPS or vaccines. These are things that came about in part originally due to government-supported research and development. Is there a place for that in this free market?
Not ideally. I don't think you need it. Everything that government did, it had to do it with the capital and the wealth that had been created, not by the government, but by people working in the market process. So any particular, for instance, take the railroads. The railroads that went out west, there's still an argument among economists, were they economically efficient? What we know is the government taxed people and said, we're going to use this tax money to create railroads. What might have been produced if it hadn't been those railroads at that time? Maybe the correct answer is that the railroads would have been a good bet 10 or 20 years later, but not exactly when they happened. Maybe the government accidentally got the year exactly right, but I would doubt that. People make better decisions when they're spending their own money in their own interest than when they're spending other people's money in somebody else's interest. So while we might be able to point to, hey, we got Tang from the space program, what might we have gotten if the money had been left in the private sector, left in the hands of the people who were producing it? So, yeah, we got the very basic framework of the internet. But the fact that you have all the knowledge in the history of the world there in your pocket has very little to do with the government. It has to do with a lot of companies out here and companies up in Redmond, Washington, and companies all over the world that found opportunities to use that basic thing. Now, does that mean that there needs to be at least the basic research? Well, that's certainly debatable, and those tens of millions of potential libertarians out there, I'm sure they wouldn't take as radical a view of it as I would. But there are certainly scientists and economists who would say, no, you didn't need the government for that.
I'm not a big fan of Tang, for the record. I think we probably all could have done without that, perhaps. But I was thinking more along the lines of you know, the anti-malarial drug that there's really no money in making necessarily, and yet may save, you know, thousands or millions of lives around the world, as opposed to the Botox that there's definitely a market for. You know, is there some sort of motivating factor other than just profit and prosperity that has to be brought to bear in certain sectors of an otherwise free market economy?
What you're saying is that there are hundreds of millions of people who are out there working, trying to make their families' lives better, but that some group of experts, whether it's you or the Congress of the United States, you want Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell to get together and decide how an economy ought to work. That's not my idea of the way the economy ought to work. I think we should be very cautious and humble about substituting our own opinion by force for the results of the market process. And again, what we don't know is government is currently taking about 40% of all the income we produce. What might be produced with that 40% if it was left in the hands of people who are looking for good opportunities? Now, there's certainly no libertarian objection to charity, and I think there would be more charity and more philanthropy if people were not having 40% of their money taken by the government. A lot of the things that are being done, for instance, to benefit people with diseases in Africa today are being done by the Gates Foundation and other foundations, not by government. And if you talk to people in those agencies, they will often say, we're doing it much more efficiently and on the spot and intelligently than the government aid agencies are.
Okay. When we talk about what would be done with that extra 40% of the wealth, of the income that's out there, rather than going to government, what we've seen in the past 30 years at least, 30, 35 years, is a growing concentration of that wealth in fewer and fewer hands. Now, I saw later on in the book you say that it's right to be concerned about the dangers of a permanent system of rich and poor, a caste system in which the rich get richer and the poorer middle class can't climb, but that doesn't seem to be the way competitive markets actually work. Well, then what's been going on for the past 35 years?
Well, certainly not the poor getting poorer, not in America. Most of the poor have smartphones. They're just not getting poorer. The rich are getting richer, absolutely. Yeah. Every day that the market goes up, Bill Gates is richer than he was the day before.
Right.
Every day that the market goes up, I am a tiny bit richer than I was the day before. And there are people who are not any richer at all just by virtue of the market going up. But they are absolutely better off than they would have been in a society where we were not letting the Bill Gateses and the Sam Waltons and the Steve Jobses and thousands and hundreds of thousands of engineers who worked with them get rich. So I think one of the things you have to think about when you think about inequality is it actual inequality that you're concerned about? Because every day that Microsoft stock goes up, the inequality gap between me and Bill Gates rises. I don't think that's anything to worry about. What would be a problem to worry about is if poor people were getting poorer, and that's just not the case in modern America. Or if middle-class wages are stagnant, and they are to some extent, but again, if you think about the kind of life that you have today and that your parents had 30 years ago, almost certainly, and obviously this can't apply to every single person, but homes are bigger, homes have air conditioning. I grew up in a home without central air conditioning. I grew up with a car without air conditioning. Cars are fabulously better, even the cheap ones. Technology is amazingly better. As I say, you have all the knowledge, not necessarily the wisdom, but all the knowledge in the history of the world in your pocket. And that is available to people who have very little money. So even the concept of stagnant middle class wages, I think, is overstated. However, we do a lot in this country that protects the rich and the incumbents and the people who are already there. And we ought to change those laws. We ought to stop bailing out the big banks. At a much different level, we ought to stop protecting the taxi monopoly and let companies like Uber and Lyft compete with it. We ought to stop subsidizing generally larger farms. We don't need any farm subsidies. We don't need to subsidize businesses. Right now, one of the big fights in Washington is the Export-Import Bank. Pure corporate welfare, 70% of its loans go to one company. How could you have a more pure example of exacerbating inequality? The big company is Boeing. We ought to get rid of it. You know what's going to happen in Congress? They don't even have to do anything. You hear about the do-nothing Congress. If they do nothing, the Export-Import Bank will expire. But that's not what's going to happen. The Tea Party and libertarian-leaning Republicans are going to vote not to reconstitute it. Some of the Bernie Sanders left-wing Democrats are going to vote not to. And the center of both parties is going to vote to keep it around because that's the way it works when you have a government that is able to hand out these benefits. So what libertarians want to do is take away from government the power to hand out benefits, which inevitably are going to the most politically connected, most politically powerful groups.
And that sort of takes care of the problem of what I think of as fair-weather libertarianism, you know, such as the person who shows up at a Tea Party rally protesting the government-run socialist health care of Obamacare, but they are you know, surviving essentially on Medicare and they don't want that to be touched, or the bank that is constantly lobbying against any sort of regulation or oversight and yet is quick to take the TARP money, you know, when things go to pot. So your solution is just don't even have any of that available, Medicare, TARP, Obamacare, whatever it is, in the first
place.
I'm
willing to start by getting rid of the programs that clearly redistribute income upward, like Ex-Im Bank, corporate welfare, TARP, and even the taxi cartel. But yes, I think government should also be deprived of its power to redistribute wealth to any group. And I think that we would be better off if we relied more on markets, philanthropy, private charity, self-help, mutual aid, than when we rely on government to, as I say, tax 40% of our income and then decide to redistribute it.
Question from the audience. If people come together and decide to do something collectively, including collecting money to pay for it, is that government, and why or why not? And the example that this the audience member gave was our war for independence.
Well, a war for independence is sort of inevitably not government because it is a rebellion. The answer, I think, to the larger question, if people come together voluntarily and choose to pool their money for some common cause, whether it is building a church or performing charity or building a library, then I guess I wouldn't call that government if it's voluntarily entered into. If what you mean is that 51% of the people come together and decide to order the other 49% of the people to contribute to whatever my favorite cause is, then yes, absolutely, that's government.
A tyranny of the majority.
Yes, although it's usually not even a majority. It's a majority of the politically active or politically connected.
Let's take a quick sidestep, jumping off of that, into civic engagement. You know, we're coming off the worst turnout that we have ever seen in a California election, essentially, last year. It is increasingly hard to get people to the polls. Obviously, a libertarian standpoint would not be in favor of making voting mandatory, clearly. But how do you get people engaged in the system where there is so much at stake? No matter whether you want to pass laws or repeal them, you need to choose who you're going to send there to do it, right? So,
well, you know what they say. If God wanted us to vote, he'd give us candidates worth voting for. I mean, if people don't find any of the candidates worth voting for, then that is a that should be embarrassing to the candidates. People know when the election is. If they don't think it matters, if they don't think it's going to matter to their lives, then I understand that attitude. Now, I usually vote. For me, it's a consumption good. I like voting against people. And there's always people to vote against. But how many real choices do we have? If I wanted to get rid of the Export-Import Bank, who do I vote for?
You have a name you want to throw
out? No, no. I don't think there are very many choices. I think that partly because we have a two-party system where both parties gravitate toward the middle, the choices tend not to be that broad. And I think I make this point in the book, each party gives you a package of options. For instance, Bush's package might have been, let's cut taxes and start an endless war in the Middle East. That's not exactly the package I would prefer. If I were buying a car, that is not the package of options I would select. On the other hand, the Democratic nominee is saying, ideally, let's not get into an endless war in the Middle East, although, in fact, most of the Democrats did vote for it. But the platonic ideal of a Democrat would say, we're not going to, but I'm going to raise your taxes. Okay, that's not the package of options I want either. So now what do? I'm stuck with this package deal. Whereas when I go to buy a car, there's lots of different packages. And that's one of the reasons the market works better than the market in government. And furthermore, the candidates are probably not telling you the truth anyway.
Since you mentioned the Middle East, we have a audience member who would want to know how a libertarian president would be handling negotiations with Iran. And I would widen that a little bit to say, you know, what is the libertarian ideal of foreign policy in the first place? Would we have business having these negotiations with Iran in the first place? And if we don't, then what are the consequences of that?
Well, I think the general classical liberal libertarian position on war is that war is a terrible thing. It not only kills people, It destroys property, it destroys wealth, it destroys families, it destroys societies and civilizations. One of the results of World War I was the Bolshevik Revolution and the Soviet Union. Those are consequences that we should seek very hard to avoid. Now, so what that means for libertarians generally is governments are bad enough here at home. Let's not arm them and send them going abroad overseas looking for opportunities to intervene. Libertarians generally are opposed to government intervention overseas. Now, if we're attacked, as we were on 9/11, then I think it was reasonable for the United States to retaliate against the people who attacked us and the people who harbored, who provided them with a safe haven. And we did that in Afghanistan. And even there, of course, the consequences have been, what is it now, a 14-year war. So that's not exactly a good outcome. Iraq, I think, was a different matter, a war of choice that we didn't need to go into. I'm in favor of diplomacy. I would love for Iran not to have nuclear weapons. I have no particular advice on how should the president handle the negotiations, but I definitely think negotiations are better than saber-rattling, better than getting involved in a war with the most powerful country in the Middle East. So, yes, I hope the negotiations will proceed and we'll find a solution.
Swinging back to the domestic policy, an audience member would like to know, how does libertarian politics provide for better education in a situation where so much seems to depend upon where you live, the affluence of the area in which you live, or your ability to go to a private school if the public schools are not adequate? If education is to be the bedrock of a civil society and the ability to get jobs that allow one to provide for oneself and one's family, how do we guarantee that people can get a decent education?
Guarantee is a challenging word. So much of government is wishful thinking. We call it foreign aid, even though it probably doesn't aid the people in other countries. We call it Social Security, even though it's a tremendously insecure investment right now with a $12 trillion unfunded liability. We say in the private sector, not everyone is getting a decent education. Therefore, the government should guarantee that everyone get a decent education. Okay, they've been doing that for 100 years. How's that working out? Not so well, I would suggest. Not well at all. Lots of people are not getting a decent education. Government monopolies don't work very well. Imagine if we had a government food monopoly like they did in the Soviet Union. How was the food in the Soviet Union? Not good. What kind of incentive does the government food manager have to provide better food? What kind of incentive does the school board or the principal have to provide better education? Now, there are plenty of teachers and principals who are really dedicated people, and they want to provide good education. They are often hamstrung by regulations, orders from above, from the state, from the federal government. How much better off they would be if they could work in schools where everybody was united in a vision of what that school wanted to provide. So what I would like to see is more people being able to go to private schools. And one way to do that is to have a completely free market in education, get government out of the business of education. If there are children who can't afford education, let's have charities to help with that. But we don't have to go that far. We could have, for instance, educational savings accounts, as some states are starting to do, where you can put money in an account tax-free, use it to purchase a better education for your children. Or we could have education tax credits where you can spend money on the education of your children and take a tax credit off your tax bill. Or I could spend money on the education of children other than my own, who presumably would be poor children, and I can get a tax credit, and lots more children could get into either public schools outside their own geographical area or private schools. We know, on the whole, that private schools provide a better education than government schools do. So why not let there be more private schools competing for the custom of more families? Tax credits would do that.
That said, you know, assuming that, that we establish a system of tax credits and savings to allow for private education, there still has to be money to save. You know, we're talking about a system in which people will be wholly responsible for paying for their children's education, paying for their health care, paying for an innumerable number of things in a society where, you know, the bottom 40 or 50% of our populace is struggling to put food on the table on a regular basis.
No, that's just not true.
Well,
it's just not
struggling.
Come on, struggling
to put food on the table.
No,
but
not.
It's struggling to make ends meet at a standard of living that they have become accustomed to. Do we lower expectations of the standard of living?
Absolutely not. Are you kidding? If we had that 40%, remember, if the government takes 40%, it means I have 60% less, which means if I got the 40% back, that is a 2/3 increase in my income. Would we have a lower standard of living in that case? Absolutely not. We'd have a much higher standard of living. So could people afford education in that circumstance? Of course they could. The other thing is, how much cheaper might education be if we actually had competing private providers figuring out how to do it efficiently? Do you think it really takes 12 years with 9 months and 6 hours in a classroom in order to teach kids what they learn by the end of high school? I don't think so. I think that competing private providers, especially using the technology of today, could deliver all of that information a lot sooner, which would mean it would cost a lot less money. Now look, in any society, there's not going to be full equality. Of course not. You never had that in the Soviet Union or Mao's China. You're not going to have it in any society. We're better off having money as the unit that allows you to get something better for your family than political pull. When societies get more politicized, it's pull that matters. That's a harder commodity to get hold of, and it generally involves uglier things to do in order to get it. So when you mention education tax credits, if you create a system of education tax credits, you're not saying in that circumstance that people can't still go to the public school. They can if they want to. It's just that they would have another option, and I think people are generally better off if they're given more options.
With that shift to those options and that additional capital with which to pursue those options, wouldn't there be a period of transition? I mean, I assume this would have to be phased in some way so that there's not a lost generation of children who are unable to afford a decent education while we make that shift into that system, or a lost generation of medical patients who do not yet have the savings to afford a life-saving surgery or hospital treatment or whatever.
Well, let's talk about education tax credits. If California said, starting next June 1, we have an education tax credit system, you still want to go to the public school, it's there, you can go to it. But if you'd like to send your child to a private school and then deduct that amount of money or some level of money from your tax bill, you can do that. How would that create a lost generation? What I see there is some number of children now get to go to private school, and there will be more private schools because now there are more customers, and some number of children will still stay in the public schools. My prediction would be people will see that the private schools are better. They will talk to the people on their block and say, how does your son like that school? And they will find out that the kids generally like and the parents generally like the private schools better. And the next year, instead of 5%, it'll be 10% who are choosing that. And then it'll be 20%. But there's no lost generation. There's still the schools. In fact, the challenge at that point would be to get the government to start closing the schools that nobody wants to go to. Because, as you know, it is extremely difficult to close any government program. And so we're likely to be stuck with just as we're currently stuck with a post office that nobody really wants to use because we all use email now, but we've still got 500,000 postal employees. So I don't see how there is going to be any lost generation if you allow people more choices.
From the audience, what about the need for government financial regulation of banks or ecological regulation of corporations? How can we trust decisions for the public good to short-sighted, profit-driven companies?
Well, those are two very big questions. One thing I would challenge is I don't think that private sector decisions are as short-sighted as government decisions. Governments are always looking at the next election. Private corporations know that the value of their shares is influenced by people's estimate of how valuable the company is going to be over years to come. My economic decisions are certainly made with some long-term perspective. There are lots of things I would like to buy today that I don't because I need to save for retirement. I think the government, for instance, is much bigger on opening new facilities than it is on maintaining roads and bridges. Now, why is that? Because you get a lot of attention when you open a new facility, but nobody ever goes to the ribbon cutting of a filled-in pothole. So I think you're getting bad decisions when you do that. Those are the short-sighted decisions. Now, talk about the banks. Banking regulation. Banking regulation is what caused the financial crisis. We had regulations that told the banks to make loans to people who weren't going to be able to pay them back. We had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac eagerly buying up those loans that were not going to be sustainable. And we had the Federal Reserve pumping money into this system. We got the American home ownership rate up to its highest number ever, and we ended up with a financial crash. So I think the problem there was too much government regulation, not too little. Environmental issues are much more complicated than that, I think. I believe that you're better off if you're relying on property rights, including my property right to the clean water in the water that I own or have a continuing stake in. If you rely on property rights, markets, decentralization, rather than, again, one group of supposed experts in Washington making decisions for the whole country. However, those are complicated issues, and I think the environment is something that there is a book called Free Market Environmentalism, and I urge people to read that. But it's a challenging thing, I think, for any political system, for any political philosophy that actually wants to have principles and rules on which we decide what the government should do.
Related to the environmental question, an audience member would like to know, how would a libertarian address climate change before it's too late?
Well, the first question is to determine whether we are in a before-it's-too-late situation. There is scientific disagreement over that. Most climate scientists, including one who works at the Cato Institute, who is a widely published climatologist, believe that the Earth is warming, that it is partly man-made, but many of them, including many of the ones who are often listed on those lists of all climate scientists believe, do not believe that this is going to be catastrophic or even dangerous. The numbers, the amount of warming that is actually predicted, if you read down into the 600-page, 1,200-page reports, it's not that great. The numbers you hear about 2-foot rise in sea level, not sustained in the actual climatological literature. So the first thing a libertarian would say is, let's find out how much of a problem it is. Let's find out when that problem might take place. Because if we're talking about a problem likely to occur 100 years from now, then we should think about how much wealthier will our society be 50 years from now, 100 years from now, and how much more technologically advanced? And might we be able to make better judgments at that point than we're able to now to avert this problem at a smaller cost? As you know, the hottest recorded year was 1998. We haven't gotten back to that level. The models that people are always using all said that temperature would continue to warm beyond 1998, but it hasn't. That should give all of us pause to think about what's wrong with these models. Maybe we shouldn't make policy on the basis of these models. So that's where this libertarian, I can't say what all libertarians would think.
Right. Essentially, we're saying that if there is a problem a century down the line, let's wait and buy our way out of it halfway there, rather than trying to make any moves now.
Who knows how long it would be, but the things that are proposed to avert global warming are so costly in terms of lives and standard of living that we ought to be very careful before moving in that direction. And one of the ways to be careful is to think about whether this is an issue that needs to be watched and studied or needs to be dealt with severe public policy mandates now.
And on the other prong of that original question on the financial, the banking regulation, the club is hosting Barney Frank tomorrow in San Francisco. Anything you want me to ask him about Dodd-Frank?
Well, first I would ask him why he was such a huge defender of Fannie Mae, insisting against all evidence that Fannie Mae would never run into a financial problem and would never draw on the full faith and credit of the U.S. Treasury, because that turned out to be wrong, and a lot of people knew it was wrong at the time. Dodd-Frank, I'm really not an expert on, but I believe that it was passed in answer to a misunderstanding of the problem. The problem was not an excess of zeal on Wall Street. The question to ask is, why did all these companies make decisions that went bad at once? And my view would be, the companies don't all make the same bad decision at once unless there's bad public policy guiding them. And I think the bad public policy was the manipulation of the money supply by the Federal Reserve and the regulations pushing these banks to purchase, to lend money that was never going to be paid back.
I think there are some who would respond to that by saying that the bad decisions were made by these companies all at the time, at the same time, because all of these companies were getting exceedingly rich from these policies right up to the minute that it destabilized the entire economy.
That's a possibility, I guess. But the fact is that it was so pervasive that, you know, not everybody in Silicon Valley is getting rich, but many companies in Silicon Valley are getting rich. But they don't seem to be all being led into the same bad technology at one time. You know, when you talk about you want guarantees and you want uniformity, and that means public policy that mandates things, that's where you put all your eggs in one basket. You know, 20 years ago, the California Superintendent of Public Education held a press conference to announce, I believe her literal words were, "We goofed. We went to the wrong kind of teaching reading." Basically, I think it was switching from phonics to the look-say method. And it turned out it didn't work. And a generation, probably not 30 years, but 10 or 12 years, of California students got poor education in reading. That's the sort of thing that can happen when you have a government monopoly. It's much less likely that all the private schools, the independent schools and the Catholic schools and the for-profit schools and the Walmart schools, would all make this bad decision on reading at the same time. But when you have a superintendent of public instruction who is regulating the way education is taught to 10, 20 million students in California, you can make a huge mistake. One of the ways societies survive is don't put all your eggs in one basket. That's one of the arguments for competition, for private property, for diffusion of money and power. In this case, they put all their eggs in one basket. And I think in the case of the Federal Reserve and the banking regulations, that was an equivalent example of imposing one bad regime on all the banks.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you used Silicon Valley as the initial comparison there. Silicon Valley had its crash as well after its initial boom around 2000 or so, and you know that proved to be a investment of capital in things that weren't actually didn't actually exist in many cases, but that wasn't a crash that threatened the entire world economy. You know, people.
That's
you know,
right. It takes the federal government for that.
Well, no, you know, I mean, people may have been booted out of their jobs, and they may have had to sell their condos, and their stock options may have become worthless in that crash. But there wasn't a situation where you were about to see another Great Depression as a result of it. It was somewhat isolated. Whereas in the financial industry, because of the power, both economic and political, of these institutions, everything seemed to be on the brink at that moment, or was it not?
I think it probably was not. I think letting companies that had become insolvent go bankrupt would have been a better plan than the $800 billion TARP bailout. If you always bail out your spendthrift son, he will never learn to be frugal. If you always bail out banks that make bad decisions, even if they were led into them by bad government policies, then you will never teach banks to make better decisions. All of the kinds of protections that we have so that banks won't have to completely pay the costs of their bad decisions lead to more bad decisions. So, yeah, I think it would have been better.
There is no too big to fail in the libertarian ethos, essentially.
No, I don't know. No company should be too big to fail.
Okay.
That is, by the way, one of the ways that we exacerbate inequality, by saying if you get to be big enough, then we will never let you go out of business. We will never let you fail. That's how you create inequality.
Right. And yet, you know, this sort of loops back to what you were saying earlier about charity and local largesse taking the place of a social safety net. In a situation like this where the economy becomes destabilized, whoever's fault that may have been, and you're looking at a spike in unemployment and an inability of people to, as I said before, put food on the table in many cases. Doesn't libertarianism sort of entail a somewhat rosy view of human nature as to just how forthcoming that charity is going to be? You know, are people really going to take care of their neighbors in a time of crisis like that? Or are some people simply going to fall through the cracks? You know, and is that just the way it has to be, if so?
People fell through cracks in the sense that just because the banks were bailed out didn't mean everybody kept their home, didn't mean everybody kept their job. So when you make bad decisions like that, there are costs. The fact is we have lots of built-in safety nets in our society these days, including our own savings, our retirement plans, the fact that many households have two earners, so losing one job is not as bad as losing the only job in the household. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's heard of the Depression of 1929. Very few people have heard of the Depression of 1921, and the reason is it was a bad panic, 1920-21, but the government didn't do anything in response, and it went away. It went away immediately.
And was replaced by the worst economic cataclysm of our nation's
history.
Well,
it's not like not fixing the Depression of 1921 led to the Depression of 1929. Bad monetary policy, again, led to the Depression of 1929. But the fact is, you could have prolonged the 1921 Depression if you had had the government get in the way it did in 1929. Mm-hmm. When did the 1929 Depression end? When we sent all the boys off to war in 1942. We could have stretched out the 1920 Depression that long. James Grant, the financial writer, just wrote a book on this depression that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift a little bit to some social issues here. An audience member would like to know, does the libertarian belief system include giving women reproductive rights and freedom, or is this the one case in which the libertarian would want the government to be involved?
Well, I think libertarians can have different views about abortion rights. Libertarians believe the purpose of the government is to protect life, liberty, and property. Well, so protect life, protect liberty. How exactly do you sort through the way that is related to reproductive rights? And I think the answer is most libertarians are pro-choice on those questions. Some libertarians are pro-life. And what I notice among libertarians is, as you know, the pro-life, pro-choice argument is very polarized and fraught with tension in America. But what I find among libertarians who are either pro-life or pro-choice is generally a greater degree of respect for the other position. You can understand how a libertarian would come to the other position, and you can talk through it in a way that I find most pro-life and pro-choice Americans are not able to. So I think the answer is it is my own observation, and there is some survey data to say libertarians are probably two-thirds, three-fourths pro-choice. But, you know, we're not a democratic centralist organization. Dissent is allowed.
I gotcha. back to foreign policy for a moment. Again from the audience. Should a libertarian president and or Congress continue to provide military aid to Israel, Egypt, Pakistan, etc.? I would expand that and conflate it with another question, or combine it with another question, that dealt with the threat of fundamentalist Islamic terrorism that the country has faced over the past 15 years. Where does the engagement start and stop in the libertarian ethos, and how do we distinguish libertarianism from isolationism? And is a very limited sort of approach really a practical approach in a world that has been changed by technology as it has, where we know what happens around the world in the blink of an eye, where the capability to deliver harm around the world has changed radically in the past 100 years?
Well, again, let me say libertarians don't always agree on these questions. There certainly are libertarians, people who would say, I believe in personal freedom and economic freedom. I believe in the fundamental rights guaranteed in the Declaration and the Constitution. And I believe the U.S. government needs to be robustly involved in confronting evil and tyranny around the world. I think that's the wrong application of the libertarian view, but there are people who hold that. The way to distinguish non-interventionism from isolationism is that isolationists typically want to isolate the country from the rest of the world. They typically are protectionist. They typically want cultural isolation. They're anti-immigration. Libertarians are cosmopolitans. We believe in free trade. We believe in liberal immigration rules. We believe in cultural engagement. We are liberals in that sense. We want a liberal world in which more people can flourish. Now, the question is, does political and military involvement around the world help lead to more human flourishing? And that's where I would argue it does not. We should try to avoid intervention in all sorts of wars around the world. There are some terrible things going on in the world. They're not all in the Middle East. There are a lot of terrible governments in Africa. There's some terrible governments in Central Asia. I don't think the United States should get involved there. And so when you talk about economic and military aid to Israel, Egypt, Pakistan, and a slew of other countries, I think libertarians would want to cut that off.
Which actually sort of covers the root of many of these terrible governments, which is that over the years, in the Middle East and elsewhere, we have meddled in other countries' affairs in a way that destabilized those countries for decades, and possibly to this present day. So,
In a lot of cases, yes, we have destabilized countries, and in a lot of cases, we have also created a great deal of anger at the United States. So mm-hmm. One of the reasons there is a terrorist problem. Robert Pape of the University of Chicago did probably the best study of all the terrorist groups he could find in the world, and he said the primary thing they object to is occupation by a foreign power. It's not that the Irish dislike tea and Victorian Christmas. They dislike the British Army being on Irish soil. And similarly, in the Middle East, there is a lot of objection to what they consider crusader states being in the Middle East. So, yeah, I think there would be less of that if the United States and some other countries meddled less outside their own borders.
All right. Question from the audience, near and dear to my heart. Would you discuss the press in a libertarian world, a more realistic watchdog?
Well, I would hope so. However, you know, we libertarians believe in freedom of speech, freedom of the press. We're pretty much First Amendment absolutists. So I would absolutely hope that there would be more aggressive journalism. However, we have pretty much a strong First Amendment already. And so whatever flaws we see in the press, I can't guarantee that some further adherence to the rules of the First Amendment would necessarily guarantee that the press itself would be more robust. But certainly The press plays a very important role in a free society in exposing wrongdoing, both in private sector and the government sector.
Let's shift from First Amendment to Second Amendment. Another question from the audience. If a libertarian could get into a presidential debate, how would she or he handle the gun control issue?
Well, I think she or he would strongly endorse all 10 of the Bill of Rights, including the Second Amendment. There were libertarians a few years ago who fought a lawsuit that came to be known, I believe, as Heller v. the District of Columbia, in which the Supreme Court affirmed that the Second Amendment protects the individual right to bear arms and struck down the stringent gun control laws of the District of Columbia. And then a subsequent lawsuit, McDonald v. Chicago, I guess it was, affirmed that that applies to the states as well as to the District of Columbia. So I'm not exactly a Second Amendment absolutist. I don't think there is an individual right to own a nuclear weapon, but I do believe that rifles and handguns are covered by the Second Amendment, and I believe in people's rights to own them.
How do you think your own background, your upbringing, has colored your views, has shaped your worldview? You described a Leave It to Beaver childhood once, actually, in your Kentucky town of about 10,000 people. How would that differ from somebody who was born and raised in Oakland, for example? A different, very different atmosphere.
Well, I don't know. There are libertarians who have come from all sorts of backgrounds. We've been publishing or posting videos of libertarians from different backgrounds under the title Why Liberty on the libertarianism.org website, and you can see some of those descriptions. I guess one thing would be that if you had suffered under the terrible schools provided by the Oakland City government, you might resent the government school monopoly in a more visceral way than if it's more of an intellectual criticism. I believe that the welfare state has been terrible for the inner city. It has mired people in years and generations of dependency, and there are people who have come out of that circumstance and indicted it, but it's not a majority of the people there, absolutely, so I don't know. I was raised in a bookish household, and I'm sure that made a difference in the way I looked at the world. I was reading books about political ideas at a young age, but I certainly know libertarians who are not book readers, who have come to their views through their personal experiences with police, with taxes, with various other kinds of government intrusion.
You mentioned police, and that's something that's been of fascination to me over the past 10 or 20 years, is that, you know, we see both a modern liberal, and I know the background of the term liberal and what a classic liberal is versus, but the current modern liberal dissatisfaction with the way in which law enforcement is conducted in many communities of this country. We see it, you know, in the post-Ferguson protests. We see it in a lot of other contexts. We've seen it here locally. And then you also have this libertarian objection to many of the same concepts. It almost seems like there's been a meeting of the minds from the liberal side to the conservative and libertarian side on overreach in this sector. And why do you think that is?
Well, I think certainly the experience in Ferguson was a striking symbol to lots of people. And I think part of it was not just the shooting, which turned out to be complicated, but the reaction of the police after that, the reaction to peaceful protests, which were not always peaceful, but at least they started out that way, the militarization. I think people were shocked to see the armored vehicles and the police in riot gear. It looked like Iraq, but it was Ferguson, Missouri. The Cato Institute published its first paper warning against the militarization of local police in 1999. So I am delighted to see liberal Democrats discovering the problem in 2014. But if they'd been reading our papers, they might not have voted to create the militarization program somewhere in between 1999 and 2014, or to step it up. I'm not sure exactly what the vote was, but there was a vote where most of the Democratic senators voted for the program of giving military equipment to local police departments. However, we all got there, we have gotten there. I think that's a good thing. Even among conservatives, there is now a sense that maybe we're locking up too many people. Maybe that's not a very Christian thing to do. Maybe it's not a very fiscally conservative thing to do. There's a group out of Texas called Right on Crime, which has been talking about, let's think more clearly about who actually needs to be in jail. I had a conversation with Obama's drug czar back in 2009, and I tried to suggest ways that they could pull back on the drug war, and of course that did not happen. Mm-hmm. But I'm still hopeful that that might, and now that there's even a little conservative support for it, I hope that we will get some changes in civil asset forfeiture, in mandatory minimums, in the militarization of police, and even in the laws that say if you sell marijuana, you'll go to jail.
At this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Josh Richmond, political reporter for the Bay Area News Group, and your moderator for tonight's program. Our guest tonight is David Bowes, executive vice president of the Cato Institute and author of The Libertarian Mind, A Manifesto for Freedom. An audience member would like you to name any one government program that has been beneficial in American history.
National defense. I'm in favor of having a national defense. I'm in favor of having a police system. I'm in favor of having a court system. But beyond that, I think that virtually all goods and services can be provided more efficiently by competing providers than by centralized tax-supported monopolies.
You mentioned the Christian thing to do during that discussion a moment ago of police militarization and our criminal justice system. What are your thoughts on these religious freedom legislations that we've seen springing up in states across the nation? The Indiana law just made headlines in the last few days. The Arkansas legislature today passed a law that's basically identical to Indiana's. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a lot of exaggerated hysteria about what's going on. We've had a Religious Freedom Restoration Act in the United States since Clinton years. When the Supreme Court ruled that it didn't apply to the states, about 20 states promptly passed one. That included liberal states like Connecticut. Indiana never passed one. Indiana just recently passed one. It's very similar to the others. The reason Indiana's law has generated hostility is that it is perceived to be in response to the spread of gay marriage and to the spread, which is not inherent in the nature of gay marriage, the spread of lawsuits against individual photographers, bakers, and so on, who don't want to participate in gay weddings. Now, Indiana has never banned discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, nor does the federal government. So it's never actually been a legal requirement in Indiana to serve gay customers. I'm not aware of any cases in Indiana where people didn't, but it wasn't illegal. And in this particular case, in the cases of the weddings, it is not that these providers object to serving gay customers. Most times they don't know if their customers are gay. What they object to is participating in a ceremony that they regard as profoundly wrong under their interpretation of generally Christian religion. To me, it seems intolerant to find some baker in Peoria, Illinois, or Bloomington, Indiana, and say, you have got to bake a cake for a gay wedding because that's the law. It just seems to me Taliban-esque to insist that everyone obey your moral precepts. Now, it was also Taliban-esque for us to maintain laws in this country that said gay people were, it was illegal to engage in homosexual relations, or that gay people could not work for the federal government, as the federal government maintained right up until around 1980, or indeed that they could be deprived of normal adoption, marriage, immigration rules. So both sides in the culture war are at fault here, I think. I don't think the Indiana law actually changes very much, but we're having an interesting cultural moment right now that so many businesses and other people are saying, I don't want to be associated with a law that is perceived to be bigoted against gay people.
And so you see this as an issue not only of religious liberty, but of a freedom of association, essentially,
yes,
of not wanting to be involved in something with,
right,
with which you disagree. But at what point does that freedom of association in a society become a kind of tyranny of the majority, where nobody in the entire state of Indiana or Nebraska, sorry if there are any Cornhuskers out there, I'm just picking these out of a hat, or Hoosiers for that matter. You know, if there is a gay couple that wants to find that cake or wants to hire that social hall or something, and there is nobody who will do business with them, is that not a form of discrimination? Does that not disadvantage them in some way compared to the majority of people who are deciding not to associate with them?
Well, here's a problem. If there's not a single baker in the state of Indiana, which it is clear is not the case,
of course,
but if there's not a single baker in the state of Indiana who wants to bake a cake for a gay wedding, what are the odds that that state is going to pass a law requiring the bakers to do so?
Right.
It's only when you've got the majority on your side that you can pass a law like this. And then you should think about, well, now that we're the majority and we're going to impose our values, does that make us better than the people who are using their majority to impose their values? We did have a system called Jim Crow in this country. It was mostly a system of government-supported discrimination. Getting that kind of systemic discrimination on a private basis, I think, is difficult. And in any case, I believe we've made a tremendous amount of progress, even in Indiana. This is not California. In Indiana, the local conservative newspaper runs a front-page editorial titled, Fix This Now. And the Republican conservative governor of Indiana won't defend what people think was the thinking behind the law. So it looks to me like we really have had a cultural revolution faster than anyone could have imagined on the way people think about gay rights. And I'm glad to see that. And I'm glad that marriage is increasingly going to be part of that. I'm just not sure we have to chase down the last wedding photographer and force her to conform.
The last one in Muncie, right?
Yeah.
All right. A question from the audience. Assuming you don't support the way candidates are raising millions of dollars for their election campaigns, how would you pay for those campaigns? Let me stop here and think. I don't think you have a problem with the way that candidates are raising money for their campaigns, do you?
I mean, the problem I have is that government has so much power that people are willing to spend that kind of money in order to have influence over it. If we had a government actually bound by the limits on government in the Constitution, then it wouldn't be worth so much to people to influence who gets elected. But I do believe that working to support the candidate of your choice is part of my First Amendment absolutism, and that includes giving money. If you're the newspaper in Indianapolis and you can run a front-page editorial expressing your opinion, I don't see why a businessman who doesn't own a newspaper can't spend an equal amount of money advancing his own opinion. So, yes, I am in favor of a deregulated campaign finance system because I think it's part of a robust First Amendment.
And do you feel like Citizens United and McCutcheon moved us a little bit closer to that?
Yes, absolutely. Citizens United was over the question of whether a corporation could publish a book or a movie that was critical of a political candidate. I think they should be able to.
Mm-hmm. And if the Koch brothers spend $900 million on a given election, whereas most people can afford about $50, that's still an equality of rights?
There was about $1.2 billion spent on behalf of Obama, about $1 billion spent on behalf of Romney. Hmm. There's a lot of money on all sides of politics. Well, not on all sides, on both sides. The Libertarian Party had about $1 million. So
I understand the Cato different. Institute is mostly member-funded.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
A question from the audience. Why do so many people vote against their own best interest?
Well, that always assumes we know what their own best interests are better than they do. I myself, believing myself smarter than most of them, also believe that they are voting against their own best interests. But there is a certain presumptuousness in saying, I know that you are voting against your own best interest.
Well, aren't there actual objective criteria by which you can look and say, you voted for this person, you are worse off for it?
No. I mean, no? Yeah, in some sense. No matter who we voted for in the last election, we were all going to be worse off, so you didn't have much choice. But to say objective means, for instance, that you believe that this person would have been better off with a higher minimum wage but less religious influence in government, let's say. That person may not believe that's a trade-off that he wanted to make. Again, if one candidate proposes to go to war and cut my taxes, am I better off with that candidate or with some other candidate? I think that's a very difficult question to decide. I do believe one answer to the question is what economists call rational ignorance. When you go out to buy a car or a business suit or a computer, you usually spend a little time finding out what the relevant factors are and which ones are better than others. You ask your friends, you look at consumer reports, you read Yelp, and so on. You generally don't do that with political candidates because, frankly, you know it won't do any good. You're still only going to have one vote. Whereas when I go out to buy a computer, when I make the decision, I'm going to get that computer. So I had better invest some time in making sure I make the right decision. With political candidates, you don't. And therefore, we are all rationally ignorant. We don't invest the kind of time that we might. And it is rational for us to make that choice.
Here in California, we recently instituted our top two primary system in which candidates of all parties compete directly against each other in June. The top two vote-getters advance to November. Obviously, there are many places in the state where only two Democrats advance or only two Republicans advance. Third parties, including the Libertarian Party here in California, have claimed that this is the death of the third-party system. What do you think of a system like that?
I don't have strong opinions. I haven't studied it closely. It's probably true that there are many districts where it will be two Republicans in the final or two Democrats. That's not obviously a bad thing, because if it's a district where the Republican would have no shot at winning the general election, then why not have two guys or gals, each of whom could possibly win, and so you have a real election. It is true that it makes it very difficult for people to notice independent and third-party candidates, and I think that's probably a bad thing. But whether that makes it, on the whole, a bad thing, I don't know. The idea, I guess, was it was supposed to alleviate the problem of very liberal Democrats and very conservative Republicans getting nominated so that there are no more moderates. But I don't know if it's had the effect of producing more moderate candidates.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, and we will take that from the audience. It seems like a lot of young people favor the libertarian movement. Both Ron and Rand Paul were very well received here in the Bay Area when they visited just last year. Why do you think that is?
Well, young people haven't hardened into traditional ideas, a set way of voting yet. So they're open to new ideas. I do think also there is a generational thing. There's clearly among young people a sea change in social attitudes toward gay marriage, toward immigration, toward marijuana, things like that. Economics, it's not quite so clear. But in my view, these young people today are living in their parents' basement because the government has put such a burden of taxes and regulation and debt on the economy that there are not enough jobs and not enough good jobs being created. So they ought to be economically free market as well as socially tolerant. We're still waiting to find out. But it's absolutely true. I went to the Students for Liberty National Conference last month. They had about 1,500 students there, and that's probably bigger than any adult libertarian convention that I know of. So, yeah, I think there is a real movement in that direction among this new generation.
So you see a bright future.
I think I definitely see a bright future. I believe that freedom works, and 100 years from now, I am confident that we will be freer than we are today. And I think these young people who are going to live to see that time 100 years from now because of improving medical technology are going to be part of that.
Very good. Our thanks to David Bowes, Executive Vice President of the Cato Institute and author of The Libertarian Mind, A Manifesto for Freedom. We also thank our audiences here, on the radio, and online. I'm Josh Richman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.